You are listening to The Natural Philosopher with Dr. Mick Pope, a podcast on science, the environment, and the Christian faith. This podcast is written and produced on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging of all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander nations, acknowledging that sovereignty has never been ceded. It always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Well, welcome to another episode of The Natural Philosopher with me, Dr. Mick Pope. It's nearly 11:30 p.m. on a Monday, and as usual, or as is often the case, I get to the start of the week and haven't done the prep that I plan to do. I do hope to, in a future episode, look at a recent book by, Jane Goodall. Name didn't want to come. Which is about hope. And I had great plans to contrast that with Terry Eagleton's Hope Without Optimism, and of course I can't find it. If you see my bookshelves, you'll understand, appreciate why there's a number of books and things go missing. I used it in writing a book on a revelation a while back, and it's gone. But anyway, hope, it seems, is in short supply. I don't know if you had hopes for COP26. There are certainly a lot of people who felt very cynical about that, and I think there was a piece in The Guardian by George Monbiot saying, well, it's governments won't fix this, we have to fix this ourselves. But good legislation is important, good infrastructure is important, governments do play a role, they have an incredibly important role to play. It's arguable that there are a number of governments, people might point the finger at Australian government, who seem to want to lock ourselves into fossil fuels for a long, long time. And as I've said many times, the science is saying that we need to stop now. To go back to an analogy about a bathtub, net zero flow of water is not the point. And there's a number of different ways of tackling the analogy. Of course, if you reach net zero just before, or just as the bathtub becomes full and you switch the tap off, well, the water runs out, okay, and over the edge, and you do the damage to your floors, whatnot. Of course, in a system that has natural perturbations, and it's so frustrating that people confuse weather with climate, but they also confuse short-term climate drivers with longer-term climate change. So, for example, southeastern Australia is undergoing a cool and wet spring, most probably because we're in a La Nina phase of the El Nino Southern Oscillation Index, which means slightly stronger than average easterly winds across the Pacific, slightly warmer sea surface temperatures than average, which gives rise to more rainfall, and also the negative phase of the Indian Ocean Dipole, which means slightly warmer than average sea surface temperatures in the eastern Indian Ocean, and fronts pick up this moisture as the warm waters evaporate more water. And that produces heavy rain. And it's very easy to quickly lose sight of the fact that it was only a couple of years ago we had a horrible, horrible, horrible fire season that climate change science points towards, on average, warmer, drier conditions, notwithstanding the internal variability that gave rise to those conditions. So we've got this really short-term memory when it's convenient. Where am I going with all this? Well, there's a bit of meandering, but the point is that... and just grabbing his name, that the president of COP26 was reduced to tears when he announced, that's Alok Sharma, that he was deeply sorry for the way COP26 unfolded, and they were trying to deliver a phase out of coal, and then countries like Australia and India and so on watered down that language. And recently I hear that the Prime Minister envisages a future for fossil fuels in this country into the 2070s. And we know that's just well beyond when we should be stopping. And the Deputy Prime Minister, Barnaby Joyce, has apparently mocked the president of COP26, saying that it's, in essence, it's not up to somebody in another country to try and stop industries in other countries like Australia. And it's worth trying to understand and appreciate that, of course, the industries bring jobs. Industries can be good for the economy, but you know, just as a smoker, oh, I know where I was before I come back to, you know, just as a smoker knows they need to give up smoking, or someone who's got a bad heart knows that they need to lose weight and give up smoking, give up drinking and start exercising in a sustainable fashion, all these sorts of things that, where am I even going with that? Now, regardless of what coal might have, the benefits it might have brought to the economy in the past, or brought to human society by sustaining growth and development, and we know that development's a key to getting countries out of poverty, etc., and that access to energy, electricity is a good thing, that we're past that point now where coal ceased to be a good, if ever it was in absolute terms, and now is an ill. Why I went to the bathtub before and climate variability is, of course, remembering that, you know, in the next few years we could break 1.5 degrees Celsius, not necessarily permanently, that's above pre-industrial levels, because imagine a bath and the taps going and you have a small, old enough child, right? And what do the children do in the bath? They have fun, they splash and they kick their legs. So we can do damage even if we switch the tap off in time to that natural variability, driving in the same direction as the warming that we're causing to cause tipping points, etc. All a bit of loose analogies. But, you know, industry, appreciate the Deputy Prime Minister's comments, but it's a failure to understand that economies can shift. Who uses a rotary phone? Who uses a computer that contains, what are they called? Not cathode ray tubes, but the big bulbs, right? It's all microprocessors. It's N generation. They're talking about quantum computing and biological computing and so on and so forth. When I had my car serviced recently, I had the tires rotated. I didn't take my horse to the farrier and get new shoes. You see what I'm saying? So I want to be able to appreciate what someone's saying about industries, but at the same time that it's just such tunnel vision. So you might be feeling depressed, saddened, or maybe just cynical and you didn't expect anything out of it. Yeah, there's some language about coal for the first time, but we know we've got so much to do in such a short amount of time. So how does the church respond to all of this? I want to come back to try and tie some things together once more with the parable of the Good Samaritan. Now, I read a whole book on how this tied into climate change. I just want to revisit that because it seems very timely. One of the other things I saw recently, there was an interview on ABC online, and it had Kelly O'Shaughnessy, who I went to university with. She's now head, not of Environment Victoria, but another environmental group that I can't remember. And there was a woman from the Pacific, if I remember, and she was a lawyer involved in human rights, particularly women's rights, as is impacted by environmental issues, particularly climate change. And she was highlighting the fact that it was so incredibly hard for nations from the Pacific, due to COVID, to get to COP26. Greta Thunberg made this comment recently that it's probably the most white Western or global North conference of the parties that we've had. And when you take into account the fact that I talked about last week, that there were more representatives just directly from the fossil fuel industry, never mind those who were part of national contingencies, more so than any other country, let alone the countries that are feeling the impacts the most right now, that you see that's a real problem with the system. Add that too to the fact that the $100 billion a year was promised to help quote-unquote developing nations, the majority world, the colonized world, whatever, those that have been shafted by global capitalism globalization. The $100 billion to help them to adapt, and that there's been a shortfall, and countries are now pushing back, rich developed countries, on not only getting up to the amount, which I think there's some agreement, but then back pay. And back pay seems to be a real problem for Western industrialized nations, because in Australia we owe Indigenous people rent because we took their land and have reaped the profits. Same in North America, and the lack of reparations for the warm upright bodies that they'd used to extract the wealth from the land. It is slaves from Africa. So it's an ongoing issue, right? Western nations don't do this kind of justice issue very well. So remember in the parable of the Good Samaritan, you have, and let's reverse engineer this because I want to think about how churches should respond to the less than thrilling outcomes of COP and what we should be standing for. In the parable of the Good Samaritan, you have two Jewish religious leaders walk past a Jewish man who's been left for dead. And standard understanding, as I've said before, is that it could be that they don't want to get in touch with what's apparently a dead body and make them ritually unclean. Let's run with that. I don't think it exhausts the meaning. I'll talk about more of that in the next half of the program as we run along. But they don't want to get their hands dirty. I've been involved in discussions online. Eternity News is doing a great job in covering climate change. I must say, go Kylie Beach and John and others involved in that. But there's ongoing battles with what appears to be, I can't say for certain, a small but vocal minority of conservative Christians. Again, that word conservative, it's a messy term. Anyway, who argue the facts over the science and will say it's unsettled. And I'm not even going to go there in this program. Of course it is. But then in a more plausible vein, want to say, maybe the church is getting distracted by this. And I've written a response. It's coming out soon. It's been pulled back by the editor from the things that I'm trying to say, and I appreciate why, and I'm happy enough with the piece, right? That's fine. Where I say that the gospel and climate change are not incompatible, I think one flows out of the other when we understand what the kingdom of God is about, what the gospel is pointing towards, the language is not as strong as I perhaps use, or at least in the direction where I need to nuance, right? Always nuance what it is you're saying. So I think sometimes, and I'm not trying to necessarily cast labels, but there certainly are Christians who think that, okay, preaching the gospel, and they mean the communication of a message, generally speaking, is the primary goal of the church, right? And I'm not disagreeing with that as such. Not going to go through all of that now, but it obviously depends upon what you understand the gospel means to be and what directly follows on from that, right? So they say that this is a distraction, and some of them will actively not engage with it or ignore it because, of course, they're worried about ideological infiltration into the church and all the sort of baggage that gets carried. And I get that, right? Because lots of people are coming at climate change from different angles. I'm not now talking about the scientists, which is not to say, of course, that scientists don't have their own worldviews. And there's lots of different ideas about what's carried in the process of science itself. Okay, no time to pull that apart. Appreciation and understanding of that needs work. But the point is that when I go to a climate change rally, for example, and you'll see the socialists and the communists and the vegans, you know, the animal rights type activists, and everyone has a barrow to push. Everyone has an idea that they want to advance, and lots of things piggyback on the back of climate change and the whole issue of the Anthropocene, precisely because people perceive, well, there's a few reasons. Obviously, you can be opportunistic, but precisely because so many things need to change to address this properly. So, you know, technology is a wonderful thing, and we'll need technology, and we'll need electric vehicles, but simply bolting on electric vehicles to the current way of doing things won't cut it for a number of reasons. We need them. We need to make a transition to them, but it's not the whole of the story. So diet may very well be part of it. How far down a particular path you go, what practices you invoke, that's a discussion for another time. But being so obsessed by either, moral purity is one thing, and it can or can't, does or does not come into involve it, but doctrinal or purity is a problem. And Jesus clearly cast it out to be a problem because, remember, the parable of the Good Samaritan is all based around who is my neighbour and loving of a neighbour. And so, you know, for example, if you could show at the very least that sea level was rising and Pacific Island nations were disappearing beneath the waves, and yes, they're our Christian brothers and sisters in many instances, even if you didn't believe that that was human-caused global warming, let's say you believed it was a direct act of God for judgment, could you, when considering Pacific Island nations, then presume to understand or know what their sin was and why they were judged, or would you instead show compassion? Even though you thought that, be it that, or even a tropical cyclone, you know, a hurricane, whatever, would you not show compassion and love towards those people and offer them aid? And this is the point of the forefront of the story. And indeed, does it matter what they believe? Because you remember the parable of the Good Samaritan. The Samaritans were, remember the whole story, the idea is that the northern kingdom was sent into exile and people from other, elsewhere were brought in. And so Samaritan belief is part Jewish and part a whole bunch of other things. It's not quote unquote pure Torah religion. And so in Jesus and setting up this parable and saying, here you've got the teachers of the law, the priest and the Levite, and here you've got a Samaritan who's theologically suspect, loving this Jewish man who's been beset by bandits, who's the one who's actually showing love? And the confession comes through gritted teeth for this teacher of the law. So the hundred, I mean, I guess it, if you don't buy into climate change at all, it makes it a bitter pill to swallow. But the $100 billion a year to help on this level, to help people adjust to climate change, is an act of love. Pure and simple. And then having immigration laws that are more flexible to allow climate refugees to have an understanding of climate refugees in the first place, and so on. But the whole point is that that package, the Green Climate Fund, is not about organising conferences, as our Prime Minister derisively said a couple of years ago. Some of it might go to that, but it's the whole idea, I don't know. But the whole idea of the Green Climate Fund is it wasn't meant to fund, presumably there are other sources of money that fund the COPs, right, from governments. But this $100 million per year is set aside for this particular deal. And so one, the first thing Christians could do, obviously, is to advocate for that, and to advocate for a more compassionate system that deals with refugees and asylum seekers, because climate change will cause more of these. And people prefer to relocate internally. That happens in India when you get massive weather events. That happened in Syria. People relocated internally. A long-term drought that caused dislocation. But when that kind of overflows, then people will want to... we'll have to go elsewhere. Anyway, that's the rant for the first half of the program. Well, welcome back, and we're looking at the whole issue of how should Christians respond given COP26 could be described as a dismal failure. In particular, tying it back to last week when I talked about the large presence of the fossil fuel industry, and notwithstanding the benefits that fossil fuels have delivered in the past, not without cost at all, that now we're more than well aware of where it's driving us, the need to pull that right back. And I brought in very briefly the parable of the Good Samaritan because I wanted to highlight the fact that, just remind us ourselves that there are Christians who think that simply because they believe the first goal, perhaps the only goal in their mind of the church, is to quote unquote preach the gospel, that means climate change action is a distraction. And I'm saying, well, if the gospel's, let's get to the point. If the gospel can be encapsulated by, for God so loved the world that he sent his only son, you know, whoever believes in him, blah, 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 that if love is central, then what's the response? And the whole Old Testament law that Jesus summed up is to love God and love your neighbor as yourself. And that's encapsulated or illustrated in the parable of the Good Samaritan. And I'm saying now, if there are those who are suffering, even if it was just natural disasters, and the church would offer to help them, with a dollar and a prayer, and if the opportunity arose, sharing the gospel. But, you know, if we're talking about Oceania, Pacifica, these are our brothers and sisters in faith. You can't go 180 degrees against James and saying, oh, you will be well clothed and, you know, live comfortably and not get your feet wet in the salt water of the rising oceans and not do something about it. And the first thing we can advocate for is to just continue to remind governments to give that money to help people to adjust. The other thing we can do, of course, is to continue to engage with conservative Christians, quote unquote, who think that it is a distraction, and work hard, and particularly because they'll come from an evangelical tradition, mostly, is to search the scriptures and understand the scriptures and be able to explain, articulate in conversation why climate change activism, as well as a whole bunch of other things that the church has traditionally done, whether or not that's working to have towards the end of slavery, or whether or not you thought that, the temperance movement, to stop people drinking because, you know, we could talk about the ills of alcohol in society, to work with those brothers and sisters in Christ to explain to them the scriptures and to have reasoned conversations, you know, reasoned, loving conversations. And that can be difficult at times. I'm not the calmest of people. I get very frustrated. And I know, and this is one of the reasons I don't always do this, is that there's a law, and I forget what it's called, and if you'll forgive me, it's that the amount of effort to counteract bullshit is very much larger than that to issue or write or speak the bullshit in the first place. But I've done that, and I do that continually when I get the opportunity, and I relish that in a way. And online it's kind of easier because you can give it a rest and walk away. So that's another thing. Just by looking at aspects of the parable of Good Samaritan, there were those who walked right past because they thought on one level, they didn't want to risk impurity and get involved in that kind of issue. There is a backstory, of course, to this, and it centers around where the bandits came from. And I've said this in a previous program, but if you've not heard it before, here it is again, is that bandits were not thieves. So there's a word in the Greek, and it's kleptes, and that's a common thief, you know, the thief that comes in the night in that parable of Jesus, from which we get the word kleptomania, those who compulsively steal, whereas lestai, it means bandit. They're social bandits, they're revolutionaries, they're kind of your Robin Hood. And of course, Jesus was crucified between two such, lestai and Barabbas, who was let go so that Jesus could be crucified, was also one of these violent revolutionaries. And of course, Jesus preached non-violence, but was crucified as a revolutionary. Now, the point is that in the first century world, the Roman armies came in and they conquered your armies. And then they would crucify whoever resisted, as well as runaway slaves. And that has bearing on how you understand Philippians 2 and Jesus becoming a servant, a slave, emptying himself. And then there was a system of toll collections. You know, Matthew Levi, the toll collector. Goods and money through the collection of taxes went back to Rome through, you know, complex trade routes and so on. And you can read about that and the judgment that's on that in Revelation chapter 11, for example. So in essence, if you lived in a largely an agrarian society and maybe you had a bad year and you had to borrow, and you were under both these Roman taxes, but also the temple tax, which the priest and the Levite drew their salary from, then there's potential that you could lose your land in a bad year and either become a day laborer, as Jesus talks about in his parables, or you become a bandit. So the very fact that a man was waylaid in the first place in the parable, the very fact that this story could be told and Jesus' listeners could go, oh yeah, we understand what this is about, is all about the injustices of the day. And you may well say, well, this is nothing to do with the point that Jesus was making, but making the point helps you understand the parable all the better. And what does it mean to say in a context like this in the first century, blessed are the peacemakers? It's not to take up arms against Rome. And eventually, interestingly enough, it's the Pharisees who believed in the bodily resurrection, who were involved in the revolt against Rome, and which led to Masada and AD 70, led to the destruction of the temple. AD 68, I think, was Masada. AD 70 is the destruction of the temple. So violent revolution in that case did not end well. But this is not to say that Jesus, in setting up these communities of believers in Galilee and indeed in Jerusalem, very much more in his Galilee wanderings, with the Sermon on the Mount, these collections of sayings that they'd given that title, on how to be the people of God, are meant to embody something very different. Now, I don't necessarily think that means that you drop out of society, the Benedict option. I know at least one person who says that jobs are sinful and you shouldn't be working for a salary, etc., etc. But you've got the likes of Zacchaeus, who maybe didn't end up working as a toll collector in the end, but worked within the system. Jesus saying to centurions, God-fearers, who came to him, well, or was it John the Baptist now, I'm thinking, about being kinder. You know, don't be a colonizing so-and-so. There are those who are within the system that can work to undermine it. So the sorts of Christian characteristics and virtues can help undo this kind of system. And remember, when Jesus told the parable of the Good Samaritan, this is first century, the first century world with the Roman Empire. And we live in democracies. You don't vote a Caesar in, but we vote our politicians in. So political activism, I think, is incredibly important. And Christians should be, you know, the ultimate swing voters. You've got your vote. Be Moses. Be Esther. Use whatever position that you're in, as an educator, as a citizen, as a voter, as an activist. There's a whole spectrum of things that can be done. And this is what annoys me a lot. And there was an article I read a little while ago on, I think it was on humility again, and it was looking at narcissism. And it was looking at the phenomena of narcissists on the right and narcissists on the left. And on the left, you can be a real, it's a virtue signaling and trying to outdo each other. So everybody knows that born again Christians can be a pain in the backside. I knew one guy when in first year uni, and he went from being a surfer and smoking a lot of weed to being, Jesus was his weed. It was very much in his personality to jump from one kind of drug to another, I guess. And so the born-again Christian could be as obnoxious as the born-again vegan, or, you know, that the only way to be a Christian activist now is to glue yourself to the road or to the bus or climb up the tree and not allow for a variety of roles, which is not, I'm not saying that there isn't room for more people willing to glue themselves to things or chain themselves to things or do those sorts of things that are like that Love Makes a Way action when people were chained by the neck to Kirribilli House. Very powerful metaphor about how, you can picture it, the Australian government chaining people up simply because they've come into the country, quote unquote, the wrong way. But we, you know, so I guess what I'm trying to say is that the backstory of the parable of the Good Samaritan says that we need to dismantle the structures that are causing people to need Good Samaritans in the first place. So the $100 billion a year is to help nations adapt to climate change. Stopping burning coal right now will mitigate against the worst ravages of that, because you tip the earth to what we're on track for, anywhere between 2.1 and 2.7 degrees. Millions will starve, there'll be water shortages in places, and people will be migrating across the planet. It's catastrophic. Get to 4 degrees and it's completely and utterly game over. Even at the kind of 2 degree range, you then want to ensure that you are doing things to store carbon back in the soil, in plants, even some of the gee whiz technologies, not to use them for future emissions, let alone carbon capture and storage, but carbon extraction to deal with the historical emissions, because people will be overwhelmed and positive feedbacks will keep forcing the climate in the wrong direction. Very small window of time. But when I say dismantle the systems, I mean, you could imagine the parable, or think about first century Palestine and say, okay, we're going to take crucifixion away, but we're going to leave Roman soldiers that can still scourge you and heavy taxes. Or, you know, we'll introduce a nicer form of centurion, a Roman soldier, and we won't give them broadswords, we'll give them spears or whatever. So it's not a matter of tweaks. It's about saying, well, what's the nature of Roman power? They need to get out of Israel, get out of Palestine. They need to stop having an exploitative system that taxes people and props up a rich elite, the 1% in Rome, and these massive border armies. It's much more systemic thinking. And all of those issues of, kind of say it, of systemic thinking are addressed by the gospel, which says that Jesus is Lord and therefore Caesar is not. That Jesus brings us peace with God, and therefore, if you go back to the whole issue in Genesis, peace with each other and peace with creation. It's not the Pax Romana that counts, or the Pax Americana, or the Pax Australis, or whatever else, the political promises. So, yes, okay, maybe we didn't expect COP26 to succeed, but you know, there are elements there of thoughts about changes in the way things are done. Because if you want to keep it below 1.5 degrees, there are things screaming out at you that no, we can't do things the same way anymore. And as I may have said on other occasions, the third working group of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the last report, so the next one's coming out next year, talked about redesigning cities so that you can walk places and cycle places. We may not all be able to have electric vehicles, but maybe if you did, it was the one that you had for life. You may not share it with your neighbor. You know, there's all those sorts of ideas about common ownership, but there's also complete utter redesign about how you get out about. The fact that during the lockdown, and I've said this before, that Jeff Bezos's net worth could just explode. Why is it inevitable that capitalism runs that way, that people can become obscenely rich when Amazon employees are not allowed to unionize? And I'm not idolizing unions, but they do aim to protect workers' rights. And if you can't unionize at all, and the work conditions are poor, many call outs to emergency for accidents that happen because people are running around like crazy to fulfill orders, which of course, you know, we engaged in retail therapy during lockdown, still do with the books that come in, but you know, as much as possible, not through Amazon. That's just my personal opinion, right? So what are the things that we could be doing? So think about in the next little while, what's your skill set? What's your skill set? And how can you use that skill set to address the power imbalances in the system? You've all got a vote. Some of you are articulate in the way in which you write, you speak. You have opportunities to speak to other Christians, to convince them of the gospel validity, for want of a better phrase, that has come to mind, of climate change action, to speak to our politicians, to demand more action, if you indeed think that's the case. Of course, clearly I do. We need to stop ripping coal out of the ground. It needs to stay there. We need a just and fair transition, obviously, for people to have jobs. But we need a just and fair transition for people in the Pacific to continue to have homes to live in. It's remember that. And this is where it ties back into Rome, that the book of Revelation is very much written to Christians suffering under Rome. And the vision of the throne room is directly invokes visions of Nero's throne room. It's saying that God's in charge now, not the rulers of this world, and that God is going to make all things new. So it's not a gospel distraction, it's an embodiment of a gospel reality. And I've got wandering about tonight worse than the Billie Holiday stand-up. And the key thing about that vision, of course, is that the vision of people of every tribe, nation, and tongue is that we need to be sticking up for our brothers and sisters in Pacifica, for those that are brothers and sisters. And I think about the things that Pastor Ray Minikin has written about. Being just fed up to be being made to feel like a dumb black by the system when he's far from a dumb person and an incredibly godly man and my brother in Christ. And we live on colonized lands, the land that was stolen from them, and now we're destroying it by mining, and I'm thinking particularly fossil fuels, but other mines, and by burning of these fossil fuels. So we engage in that love of neighbour, particularly our Christian neighbour, but Paul said, do good to all, particularly those of the household of faith, but not excluding those outside. And by engaging in climate change action and taking up the challenge that George Monbiot is saying, well, this is too important for governments, we can't just leave it to them. Taking up that challenge is the church. There's a lot of cynicism, friends, about the role of the church in all of this, because historically we've done stuff all, but now is the time to rise to the challenge, because we want to love God by loving his creation, not worshipping it. Yes, I know that. And loving our neighbours as ourselves, and saving them, both our neighbours in space, but also in time, that is the future generations, of handing on this planet, God's good creation, to future generations to care for. Anyway, again, I'm rambling. That man's tears over the failure of COP to really deliver really hit me hard. So let's get on with the task. Anyway, thank you once more for listening to my ravings, and God bless.
You have been listening to The Natural Philosopher. This podcast was written and produced by Mick Pope. The theme music is from Antonio Vivaldi's Four Seasons, conducted by John Harrison with the Wichita State University Chamber Players, and downloaded from the Free Music Archive. You can subscribe to this podcast on Podbean, Apple and Google Podcasts, and Spotify. You can also like and comment on my Facebook page, Mick Pope, Natural Philosopher.